Side 7. The Shadow of the Torturer. Continuing on page 277.
It's a gambling proposition, Dr. Talos explained, and I confess to loving them. The money in the hat is a sure thing. By the close of the first act, I can predict to an aurochop how much it will be. But the dropsies, they may be no more than two apples and a turnip, or as much as the imagination can encompass. We have found a baby pig. Delicious, so Baldanders told me when he ate it. We have found a baby. We have found a gold-headed stick, and I retain it. Antique brooches. Shoes. We frequently find shoes of all kinds. Just now I have found a woman's parasol. He held it up. This will be just the thing to keep the sun from our fair Jolenta when we go strolling tomorrow.
Jolenta straightened up as people do who are straining not to stoop. Above the waist, her creamy amplitude was such that her spine must have been curved backward to balance the weight.
If we're going to an inn tonight, I'd like to go now, she said. I'm very tired, Doctor.
I was exhausted myself.
An inn? Tonight? A criminal waste of funds. Look at it this way, my dear. The nearest is a league away, at the very least, and it would take Baldanders and me a watch to pack the scenery and properties, even with the help of this friendly angel of torment. By the time we reached the inn, at that rate, the horizon would be under the sun, the cocks would be crowing, and like as not, 1,000 fools would be rising, banging their doors and throwing their slops.
Baldanders grunted, I thought in confirmation, then struck with his boot as if at some venomous thing he had discovered in the grass. Dr. Talos threw wide his arms to embrace the universe.
While here, my dear, beneath stars that are the personal and cherished property of the ingrate, we have all anyone could wish for the most salubrious rest. There's just chill enough in the air tonight to make sleepers grateful for the warmth of their coverings and the heat of the fire, and not a hint of rain. Here we will camp. Here we will break our fast in the morning, and from here we will walk renewed in the joyful hours when the day is young.
I said, You mentioned something about breakfast. Is there any food now? Dorcas and I are hungry.
Of course there is. I see Baldanders has just picked up a basket of yams.
Several members of our erstwhile audience must have been farm people returning from a market with whatever produce they had been unable to sell. Besides the yams, we had eventually a pair of squabs and several stalks of young sugarcane. There was not much bedding, but there was some, and Dr. Talos himself used none of it, saying he would sit up and watch the fire, and perhaps nap later in the chair that had been the autarch's throne and the inquisitor's bench a short time before. Chapter 33. Five Legs. For perhaps a watch I lay awake. I soon realized that Dr. Talos was not going to sleep, but I clung to the hope that he would leave us for one reason or another. He sat for a time as if deep in thought, then stood and began to pace up and down before the fire. His was an immobile yet expressive face. A slight movement of one eyebrow or the cocking of his head could change it utterly. And as he passed back and forth before my half-closed eyes, I saw sorrow, glee, desire, ennui, resolution, and a score of other emotions that have no names flicker across that vulpine mask. At last he began to swing his cane at the blossoms of wild flowers. In a short time he had decapitated all those within a dozen steps of the fire. I waited until I could no longer see his erect, energetic figure, and only faintly hear the whistling strokes of his cane. Then slowly I drew forth the gem. It was as if I held a star, a thing that burned in the night. Dorcas was asleep, and though I had hoped that we could examine the gem together, I forbore from waking her. The icy blue radiance waxed until I was afraid Dr. Talos would see it, far off as he was. I held the gem to my eye with some childish idea of viewing the fire through it as through a lens, then snatched it away. The familiar world of grass and sleepers had become no more than a dance of sparks slashed by a scimitar blade. I am not sure how old I was when Master Malrubius died. It was a number of years before I became captain, so I must have been quite a small boy. I remember very well, however, how it was when Master Palamon succeeded him as Master of Apprentices.
Master Malrubius had held that position ever since I had been aware that such a thing existed, and for weeks and perhaps months it seemed to me that Master Palamon, though I liked him as well or better, could not be our real master in the sense that Master Malrubius had been. The atmosphere of dislocation and unreality was heightened by the knowledge that Master Malrubius was not dead or even away, that he was, in fact, merely lying in his cabin, lying in the same bed he had slept in each night when he was still teaching and disciplining us. There is a saying that unseen is as good as unbeen, but in this case it was otherwise. Unseen, Master Malrubius was more palpably present than ever before. Master Palamon refused to assert that he would never return, and so every act was weighed in double scales. Would Master Palamon permit it? And what would Master Malrubius say? In the end, he said nothing. Torturers do not go to the Tower of Healing, no matter how ill. There is a belief, whether true or not I cannot say, that old scores are settled there. If I were writing this history to entertain or even to instruct, I would not digress here to discuss Master Malrubius, who must, at the moment when I thrust away the claw, have been dust for long years. But in a history, as in other things, there are necessities and necessities. I know little of literary style, but I have learned as I have progressed and find this art not so much different from my old one as might be thought. Many scores and sometimes many hundreds of persons come to watch an execution, and I have seen balconies torn from their walls by the weight of the watchers, killing more in their single crash than I in my career. These scores and hundreds may be likened to the readers of a written account. But there are others besides these spectators who must be satisfied, the authority in whose name the Carnifex acts, those who have given him money so that the condemned may have an easy or a hard death, and the Carnifex himself. The spectators will be content if there are no long delays, if the condemned is permitted to speak briefly and does it well, if the upraised blade gleams in the sun for a moment before it descends, thus giving them time to catch breath and nudge one another, and if the head falls with a satisfactory gout of blood. Similarly, you, who will some day delve in Master Oldtan's library, will require of me no long delays. Personages who are permitted to speak only briefly yet do it well, certain dramatic pauses which shall signal to you that something of import is about to occur, excitement and a sating quantity of blood. The authorities for whom the Carnifex acts, the Chiliarchs or Archons, if I may be permitted to prolong my figure of speech, will have little complaint if the condemned is prevented from escaping or much inflaming the mob, and if he is undeniably dead at the conclusion of the proceedings. That authority, as it seems to me in my writing, is the impulse that drives me to my task. Its requirements are that the subject of this work must remain central to it, not escaping into prefaces or indexes or into another work entirely, that the rhetoric not be permitted to overwhelm it, and that it be carried to a satisfactory conclusion. Those who have paid the Carnifex to make the act a painless or a painful one may be likened to the literary traditions and accepted models to which I am compelled to bow. I recall that one winter day when cold rain beat against the window of the room where he gave us our lessons, Master Malrubius, perhaps because he saw we were too dispirited for serious work, perhaps only because he was dispirited himself, told us of a certain Master Werenfrid of our guild, who in olden times, being in grave need, accepted remuneration from the enemies of the condemned and from his friends as well, and who, by stationing one party on the right of the block and the other on the left, by his great skill made it appear to each that the result was entirely satisfactory. In just this way, the contending parties of tradition pull at the writers of histories. Yes, even at autarchs. One desires ease, the other richness of experience in the execution of the writing. And I must try, in the dilemma of Master Werenfrid, but lacking his abilities, to satisfy each. This I have attempted to do. There remains the Carnifex himself. I am he. It is not enough for him to earn praise from all. It is not enough even for him to perform his function in a way he knows to be entirely creditable and in keeping with the teaching of his masters and the ancient traditions.
In addition to all this, if he is to feel full satisfaction at the moment when time lifts his own severed head by the hair, he must add to the execution some feature, however small, that is entirely his own and that he will never repeat. Only thus can he feel himself a free artist. When I shared a bed with Bald Anders, I dreamed a strange dream. And in composing this history, I did not hesitate to relate it, the relation of dreams being entirely in the literary tradition. At the time I write of now, when Dorcas and I slept under the stars with Bald Anders and Jolenta and Dr. Talos sat by, I experienced what may have been less or greater than a dream, and that is outside that tradition. I give warning to you who will later read this, that it has little bearing on what will soon follow. I give it only because it puzzled me at the time, and it will provide me with satisfaction to relate it. Yet it may be that insofar as it entered my mind and has remained there from that time to this, it affected my actions during the latter part of my narrative. With the claw safely hidden away, I lay stretched on an old blanket near the fire. Dorcas lay with her head near mine, Jolenta with her feet to mine, Bald Anders on his back on the opposite side of the fire, his thick-soled boots among the embers. Dr. Talos's chair stood near the giant's hand, but it was turned away from the fire. Whether or not he did sit in it, with his face to the night, I cannot say. For parts of the time I am going to relate, I seemed conscious of his presence in the chair. At other times I sensed that he was absent. The sky was growing lighter, I believe, than it is at full dark. Footfalls reached my ears, yet hardly disturbed my rest. Heavy, yet softly pattering, then the sound of breath, the snuffling of an animal. If I was awake, my eyes were open, but I was still so nearly in sleep that I did not turn my head. The animal approached me and sniffed at my clothes and my face. It was Triskele. And Triskele lay down with his spine pressed against my body. It did not seem odd then that he had found me, though I recall feeling a certain pleasure at seeing him again. Once more, I heard footsteps, now the slow, firm tread of a man. I knew at once that it was Master Malrubius. I could recall his step in the corridors under the tower on the days when we made the rounds of the cells. The sound was the same. He came into the circle of my vision. His cloak was dusty, as it always was, save on the most formal occasions. He drew it about him in the old way as he seated himself on a box of properties. Shivarian, name for me the seven principles of governance. It was an effort for me to speak, but I managed, in my dream, if it was a dream, to say, I do not recall that we have studied such a thing, Master.
You were always the most careless of my boys, he told me, and fell silent.
A foreboding grew on me. I sensed that if I did not reply, some tragedy would occur. At last I began weakly,
Anarchy. That is not governance, but the lack of it. I taught you that it precedes all governance. Now list the seven sorts.
Attachment to the person of the monarch. Attachment to a bloodline or other sequence of succession. Attachment to the royal state. Attachment to a code legitimizing the governing state. Attachment to the law only. Attachment to a greater or lesser board of electors as framers of the law. Attachment to an abstraction conceived as including the body of electors, other bodies giving rise to them, and numerous other elements, largely ideal.
Tolerable. Of these, which is the earliest form and which the highest?
The development is in the order given, Master, I said, but I do not recall that you ever asked before which was highest.
Master Malrubius leaned forward, his eyes burning brighter than the coals of the fire. Which is highest, Severian?
The last, Master?
You mean attachment to an abstraction, conceived as including the body of electors, other bodies giving rise to them, and numerous other elements largely ideal?
Yes, Master.
Of what kind, Severian, is your own attachment to the divine entity?
I said nothing. It may have been that I was thinking, but if so, my mind was too much filled with sleep to be conscious of its thought. Instead, I became profoundly aware of my physical surroundings. The sky above my face and all its grandeur seemed to have been made solely for my benefit and to be presented for my inspection now. I lay upon the ground as upon a woman, and the very air that surrounded me seemed a thing as admirable as crystal and as fluid as wine.
Answer me, Severian.
The first, if I have any.
To the person of the monarch?
Yes, because there is no succession.
The animal that rests beside you now would die for you. Of what kind is his attachment to you?
The first? There was no one there. I sat up. Malrubius and Triskele had vanished, yet my side felt faintly warm. Chapter 34. Morning.
You are awake, Dr. Talos said. I trust you slept well.
I had a strange dream. I stood and looked about.
There's no one here but ourselves.
As though he were reassuring a child, Dr. Talos had gestured toward Baldanders and the sleeping women.
I dreamed my dog, he has been lost for years now, came back and lay beside me. I could still feel the warmth of his body when I woke.
You were lying beside a fire, Dr. Talos pointed out. There has been no dog here.
A man, dressed much as I am. Dr. Talos shook his head.
I could not have failed to see him.
You might have dozed.
Only earlier in the evening. I have been awake for the past 2 watches.
I'll guard the stage and properties for you, I said, if you'd like to sleep now. The truth was that I was afraid to lie down again. Dr. Talos seemed to hesitate, then said,
That's very kind of you, and stiffly lowered himself onto my now dew-soaked blanket.
I took his chair, turning it so I could watch the fire. For some time I was alone with my thoughts, which were at first of my dream.